Hey, Caitlin, feel like playing a game for a minute?
Okay.
You were a college tennis player.
Uh-huh.
Want to volley a couple balls back and forth?
LOL. Do I ever?
So let's have a trope off.
Okay.
You say a trope that you see all the time. I'll hit one back to you. Let's see how long we can do this without saying the same thing twice.
Okay. Surprise child.
Returning person from the military.
An ice queen turned sap.
May December romances. Also, real fast before you volley back, why do we call them May December? Because most of the time these women are in their late 20s, early 30s, if it's the May, and December is in her 40s. Like, how fast do they think we die? I don't understand. I can't find why they're called that. If anybody has that info, give it to me. All right, anyway, May December is mine.
Boss and employee.
God. Rich girl, poor girl.
Driven apart by parents.
Ooh, good one. First love.
Oh, fake romance turned real.
Roommates.
Is this, I don't know if this is the same thing, so you can buzzer me if it is. Getting together to prompt jealousy in another person, and then you fall for each other instead.
City girl, country girl.
Different than rich girl, poor girl?
No, that can't, those are not the same. There are plenty of rich country girls and poor city girls.
Celebrity and normal person.
Butch femme.
Returning home.
A brunette and a blonde.
I'm buzzer.
I'm sorry, should I said blonde first since you are one and then the brunette?
I mean, who am I to tell you?
So one of the stereotypes we get all the time are tropes and how they're really predictable. You know, I used to completely be one of these people who knocked these off. The more you read, the more you see tropes. They're in everything. They're in absolutely everything.
Yeah, and I love going into anything, whether it's a movie, whether it's a romance novel, and say, like, I love getting kicked in the ass by what I'm engaging with. So, half the time I start a novel and I'm saying, I know how this is gonna end. I know the trope. I get what they're playing at, and then the author completely twists it and hands me my own ass back, and I love that. I think that's it's so fun when you get sort of reminded of how not smart you are.
I don't think that you're not smart. I think the author just is
The
good at
author's a really
upsetting.
good writer, yeah.
Yeah. And a lot of these authors are really fantastic writers. I think I'd sent Chris Bryant a message recently calling her a badass. Caitlin, you should really take my Twitter account away from all this. Don't let me talk to people because, you know, until you meet me, I know it's too much. I know it's too much. And I want to, I spend so much time with these individual authors curled up on my reading chair or in bed for hours. That doesn't sound right, but you know what I mean. Like, I spend a lot of time with their words. They spend much more time writing them and then I consume them very quickly. But yeah, like, just these are some really badass authors out there and really phenomenal, phenomenal people. I want to lift them up all the time.
Today, this is our fifth podcast episode.
Sure, we'll go with that.
Yes. And today we are doing something a little bit different. Instead of focusing on just one book, we thought we would instead hear from our listeners, from some of the authors that we've been able to chat with, from other lesfic readers. And we want to talk about tropes and tricks of lesbian romance novels. The question that we posed was, what do you hear the most about lesbian romance novels from people who don't read them? What are stereotypes that you're fighting against? And what do you, as a reader or a writer, wish that more people knew about lesbian romance novel? You being all of us. So I'm excited. I'm excited for this chat.
I feel super spoiled by the number of people who reached out to us via Messenger or email, and really spoiled by people who responded to a couple messages I sent them. So thank you for your time. Please know mm-hmm. it's thoroughly appreciated. And as we agreed in some of the messages, we promised to keep direct names out of dialogue, but I do want to talk about some of the things that everybody pointed out. So yeah. There's this wonderfully charged thing about being within the lesfic community where we are all very protective of each other, but we equally navigate and manage like a certain amount of secrecy as well, mm-hmm. which is kind of indicative of the negativity that comes with enjoying this genre or writing for this genre.
Mm-hmm.
Just inherently, I'm constantly fascinated and also putting my foot in my mouth because I have not figured out how all this works yet.
Yeah, I think it's been really interesting for me to come to this. You know, I started reading lesfic and lesbian romance novels not too long ago. I feel like my radar is so up. I feel like I talk about it all the time. I'm talking about it with my friends, with my coworkers, and with you, like by virtue of doing this project. And it's been really interesting for me to navigate the different reactions that I've received when talking about this project or the books that I'm reading. And for me, what made me want to do this type of episode was an article that was published by one of my local city papers. I won't name names, but it was discussing a new romance novel that was heterosexual and using phrases like quote unquote basic romance novel formula, or really diving into what I think are some negative stereotypes of romance novels in general about how it's X, Y, and Z. And it's been like a bug in my brain ever since I read it, because it was so similar to how people just innately responded to me when I said, oh, by the way, I'm doing a podcast. It's about lesbian romance novels. And people's immediate reaction was like, why? Like, what is there to say? And I've loved proving them wrong throughout this. So let's jump off. What is one thing, was there anything surprising about what you heard from the people that reached out to you?
Yeah, I was incredibly spoiled this past weekend to meet up with a friend whom I haven't seen since prior to the holiday season. And I have not been sharing with my immediate circle that we're doing this, not because I'm embarrassed, but because I'm one of the voices on the podcast and I'm still learning how to navigate physically being in a space in my life where I'm in front of the scenes instead of behind it, where I feel mm-hmm. most comfortable. And while we were talking, she had mentioned she found it. She was quite kind, had some really thoughtful insight, but shared with me along the way that we were making these novels potentially more nuanced and more literary, just more heightened and more energetic uh-huh. than maybe what was on paper. She was, without belittling them, she was basically saying we were treating our readings of these novels the same way that somebody would treat quote unquote great literature.
Interesting.
I read every book, no matter what it is, with the lens that it can be recognized for the incredible writing style that goes with it. Mm-hmm. Nothing bothers me more than being told I can only really honor dead white men's narratives
mm-hmm.
or a handful of women who've been put in to apparently prove that the Western canon's not misogynistic and racist, which it is, within the tropes and the formulaic world that is lesbian romance novels and the happily ever afters and the you know what you're going to get. There seems to be a brush off, like, you know what you're entering into the space with. So since you have some foresight into that, it can't have any any importance to it. And my reaction to this is just utter and absolute bullshit. I enter every mystery novel with the understanding that the person I'm following who is trying to figure out the mystery most likely won't die at the end. Something horrific that happens to somebody and I will have to navigate my own sense of the gore. I enter every adventure novel with an understanding that really, probably if you go back and reread the novel, the adventurer didn't need to be present. They were just around for the situation of events and, and reading them back to you. Sci-fi novels are going to be something about something that we're ignoring in real day world that we're placing into the future. There's formulas to every single genre, which is why we get to put them into said genres, because they fit within a certain shell that we've deemed that storytelling.
Right.
Romance novels have a history of being completely disregarded and completely belittled because they're mostly aimed at women. Mm-hmm. They have been done so, usually by men. I will happily post on our social media later some more of this history because it is nuanced and I'm only three books in and we're not going to do this right now. But this entire erasure that happens within romance really, really kind of gets under my skin and blows my mind. With no mean spirit or ill intention, I even came from a family that kind of belittles romance. When you ask them what they read, it's X, Y, Z, except for one other genre and romance. Romance was always less than two whatever. I don't agree, obviously, since we're doing this. And when it comes to lesfic, I feel like it falls into an even deeper category of that because we are a population of people, and I've said it before, it is narratives about women falling in love with women for women or for people who support women. So where it already gets erased, it gets even more erased as it goes further down. I don't know if it's because there's not a male gaze in it or what, but somehow it has less merit than other romance, and romance apparently has less merit than other genres.
Yeah, no, I'm really interested in that because I think there's something about romance as a genre. As soon as people figured out that they could make money from publishing romance novels, it was aimed at women, and it was sort of like, well, we're not a serious publishing company, but we're going to make a shit ton of money from the bored housewives, quote unquote. And I think that's something that's really permeated ever like culture. There have been several authors who have made the good point that even people who don't read, like people who don't pick up a book on a regular basis, even feel like they can belittle the genre of romance because it's just kind of this cultural joke at this point that it's not literary and it's not serious. And I think there's some serious misogyny embedded in that. And I think we don't have time to do this today, but I'm really interested in exploring the history of lesbian pulp fiction, books that were published in the 50s and 60s by little tiny, you know, small stream presses that were kind of what we today consider tawdry and miserable and not very well done. Those were important both for the women writing them and for the women reading them as sort of indicators and markers that there existed in the world people who felt same-sex desire. And I do feel like there's a connection between the underground nature of those novels and the way that they've been studied and presented as historical artifacts, i.e. they really haven't been until pretty recently. I think there's a connection between that history and the fact that lesbian romance novels today feel like something you can kind of like put in the corner and don't have to think much about because it's, you know, it's this little niche thing. I was really interested. One of the responses that I got, because I did also get the, I can't believe you're reading that, or I got something that someone told to me before they listened to the podcast, because I was tipsy in a bar talking about why we should all be reading lesbian romance novels. They said, the way you talk about this makes me want to read it, but I similar to what your friend was saying, the way you're talking about it is lending it so much nuance that I don't believe, and this person hadn't read any before, but they didn't believe that it would be there on the pages for them. So I hope that they've picked up some lesbian romance novels and have seen that nuance, because we're not making, you know, we're not adding to that. We're not making that up.
We keep using lesfic as a giant umbrella, and within that umbrella, there's contemporary romance, historical romance, but also mystery, sci-fi, fantasy, basically any narrative of two female-identified characters finding romance with each other gets put into this category. Mm-hmm. And if it weighs as anything else, as drama, as sci-fi, as mystery, it somehow gets pushed back into lesfic as an umbrella term and then makes it dismissive. Mm-hmm. But a lot of what I read that we haven't posted yet is a lot more nuanced in mystery and really kind of politically driven, because as women, everything about us is always politically saturated in some form or fashion.
Yeah.
Simply because we're an underrepresented gender with unequal protections. That's just the beginning and the end of it, sadly. I'm thoroughly confused by people who dismiss it, but equally want to sit down and talk with me about it. And I think you've expressed this before as well, to where a lot of people in our life that we mutually have in common have come up to either of us and said, you know, great job, guys. I'll listen to the podcast, but... And then when we're one-on-one with them, they want to talk about things we didn't discuss in the podcast and even kind of ask for recommendations. So I'm not trying to convert anybody, but obviously stigma isn't consistent.
I don't think it's made it to the podcast before, but I've talked to you about how I first started reading just like the blanket romance novels. When I was a teenager, I discovered that my mom, my aunt, and my nana had a little lending library circle, and they would pass books along. So every time they would see each other, they would give each other a bag of books. And when I, the first time I ever looked through the bag of books, it was all romance novels. It was the first time I read an oral sex scene. And I think that's not uncommon. There's definitely another stereotype that I've heard is, oh, well, that's something that like X, Y, and Z other type of person reads, not me. And I can see that in previous iterations of myself. Like, I used to go to my nana's house and it would be midnight and I'd be frantically like reading these romance novels in the dark without trying to give myself away, because I'd be like, oh, no, I'm a serious poet. This is when I was trying to be a poet. I'm a serious person. Like, I don't need, you know, these books aren't for me. And it was really interesting when I was doing research for just this podcast in general. Obviously, a ton of people are reading romance novels in general. A ton of people are reading lesbian romance novels because they're getting published in really amazing numbers. Romance novels are making huge amounts of money.
It is a billion-dollar industry. Yes.
Billion-dollar industry.
Lucrative of all the genres. And we treat it as if it has no power, which indirectly gives a lot of power to the people who do recognize it. And I think we agreed before we started to record to not discuss what's going on within the industry. But please note, we are staying on top of it. We're very much learning and trying to be as knowledgeable as possible. But the erasure of this genre and the control a very small amount of people have with power in this genre is insane. And I really plead and implore all of you to do 5 to 50 minutes of research and just kind of get your own idea about what's going on. It is a lucrative, lucrative genre. And how incredibly dismissive people are about it makes no sense to me. It's like everybody's dirty little secret that they at least enjoy one or two of these. And I've been guilty of that. Like I said, my first Kindle was strictly for books I didn't want people to know I was reading. All of my lesbian fiction was purchased through Kindle so people wouldn't see the cover. Mm-hmm. Unless I was in a queer space and I was trying to out myself, and then I'd walk around with a copy of Ruby for Jungle in my back pocket, because that's what kind of baby gay I was. But even within our own community, there's this weird, like, you can't be seen doing it. It's supposed to be hush, hush, quiet, quiet. Only the people you trust the most can know. It's a big secret when people are diehard fans of Radcliffe or Rebecca Weatherspoon or Claire Lydon, who we've talked about before. It becomes this thing of create a handle to go on Goodreads to talk about what you thought about a book, but don't even attach your real name or initials to your Goodreads review, because still somehow the idea that you enjoy these novels needs to even be secret other places.
Mm-hmm. I think it's super interesting to look at the differences in different types of literature and different types of queer media, and like what we're allowed to be proud about and uphold in certain instances and what gets shifted to the side.
Yeah. Watching kind of the queer canon develop for academia over the last almost 20 years, I entered undergrad in 2001. I find it fascinating. It's been a really unique thing to kind of watch, negotiate, and navigate, because you have these tomes and these books that have been considered just the beginning of it all. So you have Anne Bannon's collection of the Bebo Brinker series, which we're not discussing pulp too deeply, but I find Bebo ends up in queer canons a lot. You also get Rita Mae Brown's Ruby Fruit Jungle in canons, Jeanette Winterson's Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit, and I would even venture off a little bit more than that and say Dorothy Allison's work, especially her short stories in Trash or Bastard Out of Carolina, get pushed in as well. And it often becomes not even about the queerness of the narrative, but the importance of the author at the time the work was written. And it does seem that within that queer canon, unless it's theory or nonfiction, we still cut that off in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. It's not continuing to grow. And the people who are within it are basically the people who survived the most amount of crap that was done to them. Oh, and if that's true too, then we have to talk about Radcliffe Hall's Well of Loneliness, which is really considered one of the, for a long time was considered one of these lesbian initial novels. And now for many people is considered a really important trans narrative when you follow Stephen's character. But that language wasn't as developed at the time of Radcliffe Hall's novel, so I have no right to say if it is a queer, be it lesbian or queer, be it gender identity novel. But even within that, the romance component gets kicked out of everything, and it becomes much more about it in context to the greater world in which it was placed.
This sort of leads me to something that I got and was the first time I heard this, was sort of taken aback by, was that someone said, well, I don't read romance novels because they're so separated from contemporary or real life. They don't reflect a real world. And I, you know, only want to read things that are really like of the moment, or like of today.
I'm glad eye rolls can't read face sound. That is the most ludicrous piece of bullshit. I'm sorry. I'm sure whomever said it didn't mean anything by it, but most of these novels take place in real time, which is why they feel dated so quickly, because they are snapshots of the world in which the author was writing at that time. Do you feel differently?
No, I don't feel differently. I feel exactly the same. And I'm about to nerd out. You can cut this out. I was reading a book review about it's something titled something similar to A History of Art History, and it's talking about sort of the issue of the field of art history, which I have multiple degrees in, basically talking about how it's a field in crisis and what do we do about the problem of contemporary art, because so many people today sort of feel contemporary art is stupid. And this author of this book said that contemporary art feels so unimportant or feels so different from art because it's so tied into our day-to-day experience of technology, social media, pop culture, all of this stuff. So like there's no, because we're so like living so close to it that we're never going to view our own generation's contemporary art as truly important. And that kind of feels, when you say that, that's what that feels like to me, because I agree. I read these books as so contemporary. There are already Trump jokes in a lot of these romance novels or like mentions of current politics.
And you can see when the shift happens in some of them too. You and I have chosen individually and together to read large collections by the same authors.
Mm-hmm.
And due to reading so many of the works that they've created in a very short amount of time, we have been put in a position where we can really view their work with the chances they take and the way they're writing just becomes stronger as time goes on and narrative structure. And I can see very strongly in a couple authors that we've shared a lot of books about, mm-hmm. where there's no mention really of politics. It's almost utopia with what the world looks like. And then the election of 2016 occurs.
The American election, yeah.
The American election, yes, that's very important, of 2016 occurs. Though I would argue this with a couple of the British authors we've read mm-hmm. as well.
Yeah.
With the Brexit vote that happened that year. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, characters who have never mentioned politics in any other book by the author has a one-off line or is very aware of a background energy that is beyond their control that is notated within the character's dialogue. You can watch that shift happen and you can open that book and you're like, yep, published after 2016. And mm-hmm. if you read the same author prior to that, anything that deals with politics is very, very big picture, not insular, not a single event. It's like, we talk about this frequently. We'll text each other and we're like, oh yeah, mm-hmm, that's a Trump reference, or
right.
oh yeah, all of a sudden rights may be up for negotiation, or oh yeah, these states that have never allowed two-parent adoption mm-hmm. are being highlighted in this novel, even though they were never mentioned in a novel that took place in the same state, written by the same author, because we're all socially more conscious at this point.
Or like, I was even reading one that's quite a bit older, and I'm sorry, I'm not going to remember the author in this moment, but they made a note about, you know, this was before the Supreme Court passed anything about marriage protections, like on a federal level. And there were really frank conversations about, well, we live in this state, so we can't do X, Y, and Z, but we could go over here and do A, B, C. And I've picked up on so many instances of that too, where it's not saying anything really by name, but it's an undercurrent. And I mean, I would also argue that any book that is talking about queer individuals, like, in a certain time frame, stridently deciding to start lives together or like to be open and out was at the time also political, just because it's now something that we as a reader might take for granted doesn't mean that at that time it was insular or utopic. So that one really gets me.
Yeah. So let's do the opposite that, though.
Mm-hmm.
We talked with somebody for a while through messaging where they said the thing they have to define all the time is why they're not all fluff. And where we did get into some of the seriousness, we were talking back and forth with this individual about the lifeline component of possibly seeing a world where you can be romantically involved with somebody without it being deadly, dangerous, politically motivated, and what it means to have that instead. And we call it a utopia, but arguably if it was a heterosexual cisgender couple who was navigating the exact same storyline, that type of happily ever after would just be part of the narrative. Mm-hmm. But within our community, it's this imaginary thing that nobody can actually achieve. So people justify that they don't read lesfic because it's just not believable, because our happily ever afters need to be more tainted. I sometimes just need to read something that doesn't sound like I'm back in Louisiana. As for the fluff component, I don't know. I don't think there's that many serial killers in America, and I read a lot of murder mystery as well. So I'm willing to completely go with the violence without questioning it. Right. But God forbid more than two people live happily ever after at the end of a novel. That's just not believable.
Yeah. So. I'm that asshole who's going to keep referencing different articles. Sorry, guys.
I like that you bring the receipts.
I'm really struck by the idea that we should feel ashamed for reading these works because they're so happy or they're so fluffy or they have happy endings. And it reminds me of a LitHub article from 2017 by Brandon Taylor, which is literally titled "Who Cares What Straight People Think?" And it's about the success of A Little Life, which was everywhere and is still everywhere and is written by someone who doesn't identify as queer. And it's sort of a look at really unhappy queer narratives. There's a coming out story, there's bodily violence, you know, working through really negative family structures. And what Taylor, the author of the article, is questioning is, why is the cultural gaze only interested in stories of queer suffering or queer pain? Like, what about that makes one work of literature more important versus mm-hmm. one that, instead of focusing on queer suffering, focuses on queer communities, queer happiness, people finding each other, living true lives? It just pisses me off, you know?
Yeah. Well, there's an article in Medium that talked about this too. I'll get the title and I'll tag it, you guys. I'm sorry, mm-hmm. I don't have it off the top of my head. But I think it was Ron Hogan who talked about it, and talked about, within the genre of romance, one of the most empowering things is the thing that gets erased all the time, which is about women finding empowerment through growth mm-hmm. and interaction with other people, through empathy, through friendships, through romance, working or not working in the community around yourself when that goes on, and the ability to find self-determination and self-worth due to the evolution of yourself as a unique person, as an individual, as a spirit. Mm-hmm. And we give a lot more merit to this when male characters do this through some great act beyond what most men in a real world situation would have before them, and say that's greatness and that's growth. But when you talk about finding your own experience and then using that to advance yourself as a better neighbor, as a better lover, as a better friend, then it gets erased. And since it's so internal and emotional, it also gets projected as being inherently female, which then of course also gets written off faster, because to be a woman is to be weaker because emotions are weak. Mm-hmm. I don't agree with all of this. I'm just saying this is like a parrot back of the bullshit that comes with genres about women, because romance basically takes all the things that I feel I've been told my whole life are weaker components of what make me an individual, and just says, hey, we're going to show you how all this stuff works to make you more empathetic. It makes you more deserving. It makes you more understanding. You evolve as a person because you are interacting and learning about how to interact with other human beings, which inherently makes you a better human being.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, Rebecca, I think it's time that we talk about the elephant in the room. The response that we got the most from people, readers and writers alike, is that lesbian romance novels are about nothing but sex.
All right. Short personal narrative time.
Ooh, I'm excited.
Oh, it's not that exciting. This is just... I moved to Western Louisiana right before I started high school. I learned very quickly in that part of the country that in order to get letters of recommendation and job opportunities and the like, you had to belong to a church in the 90s in Louisiana. I was a very much Wednesday Christian. What that means is I did all the youth stuff and didn't do much of the weekend stuff, including belonging to a women's group where we would discuss in detail things we as women were watching, reading, participating in. And I remember an entire Wednesday women's worship night where we talked about, as good women, the books we were responsible for reading outside of the Bible. And I remember our women's leader talking about how she really enjoys books about love, but when she knows she's going to get to one of those scenes, she just skips 5 pages and starts reading again. Because apparently in heterosexual romance, it's 5 pages and you can just start or she goes to the next chapter. But she talked about how good women don't read sex scenes. And these are really good books, but they'd be better without the sex scene. So when I started looking for myself in novels, I was in a mental position where I thought even then I needed to skip any scene of intimacy. Baby Gay Scared West Louisiana me skipped some of those scenes. Full queer, semi butch presenting Connecticut me, I read a lot of lesfic, but I'm going to be completely upfront. I read a shit ton of lesbian erotica, too. Because seeing yourself is vital. Mm-hmm. Queer sex is rebellion. You have two people who are trying to fall for each other, and sexual compatibility is really important to a long-term relationship. I want to say I have mixed feelings about lesfic and the intimate scenes that are portrayed in it. I don't. I seek out relationship narratives to see the relationship. And you can say what you want about like the voyeurism component of reading an intimate act between two people who are consenting. I can only speak as an American, but we have some weird hangups about like consensual intimate sexual acts, because I have sat through some really horrific rape scenes in movies and film and television in my life, or in books even. Mm-hmm. And there's a little bit of notation about that, but if you put two consenting adults in a room who might eventually fall in love with each other, that's taboo. Mm-hmm. Also, I really kind of enjoy reading narrative where people have premarital sex, because I grew up in a world where I basically didn't know how to be queer because I couldn't legally get married to a woman, which meant my choices were celibacy or lying the rest of my life about who I was.
The notion that these books are less than or don't have as much to say because they focus on physical intimacy, to me, is such bullshit. It irks me. I think about when I was a lit major and getting assigned to read things like Henry Miller's Tropic of Cancer, which is nothing.
The sex scene in that book alone.
That's nothing if not his diary of just having sex with like X, Y, and Z women.
Or Ernest Hemingway and To Have and to Hold, whatever that novel is. Like, mm-hmm. I had to read men write about sex in the most uncomfortable ways so often, and
I had to read men describe women's breasts as everything from like luminous golf balls to milk sacks. I don't know, like I feel like the fact that we can't like, that something that is focused on women's pleasure can't also be good or valuable, to me is just so, like, intrinsically fucked. It just speaks to deeper issues with how we view the importance of women's pleasure and women's bodies and how we view sexual intimacy. And I think
it's also this, like, weird feminine double standard, right? Okay. This sleep with the Marilyn but marry the Jackie is something I've heard many times in my life. And this idea that men can have fun with a sexually comfortable woman, but that's not the woman they bring home. And then there's this whole portrayal that that woman who's home may be reading these housewife romance novels. Mm-hmm. This whole erasure of women having a healthy sex life or wanting a healthy sex life is completely counterintuitive to the idea of a healthy marriage. And also, just women having sex. Like, you and I belong to a community where, and it's within our community too, because we both have people in our lives who, let me figure out how to word this. I don't want to overshare anything about us, but we've overshared a little bit on this podcast.
I mean, yeah.
there is a double standard even within our own community about those of us who can separate sex from emotion and sex from long-term intimacy. So I really enjoy novels where we sometimes just get two women who have sex who aren't together. And it's not even necessarily a one-night stand. It just didn't turn into a relationship. And those scenes are equally as vital to me as a person trying to see myself as the scenes with the couple that will eventually get married in these books, or if they're on primetime TV, will break up two seasons later during sweeps week. Mm-hmm. You need to see every version of who you are. And these novels are sometimes the only place I see anything even a little bit representative of who I am or who I could be or who the people around me are.
Yeah.
And sex is a big component of that. I do know even people within the community who are kind enough to talk to us, who write really, really phenomenal detailed scenes privately on their own laptop, in messaging to us, used very coded and diplomatic language, trying to express to us that they get written off as an erotica writer. Mm-hmm. And watching them navigate their messaging to us versus what we know they can write when they have time and can edit, and that's the narrative they want to tell, speaks even louder to me about how we as women try to respect the negotiation and navigation of sex speak.
I also am thinking back to the terrible book review that I talked about at the beginning of this recording. This person was reviewing a book that at the end of the day is a romance novel that explores and unpacks issues of racial identity and imbalances of power between two people in a relationship. And I was really struck by this book reviewer saying, sort of offhand, probably trying to be funny, things like, well, the racial politics of this book allowed her to talk about something besides oral sex. And to me, that's a direct quote, like, from the review, was like,
so, like, having oral sex was talking about oral sex, like, if the characters did?
Like, the person says that unpacking the protagonist's identity as a woman of color and having that be a focal point of the romance novel and her dealing with a partner who was white,
right,
having that dynamic allowed the author, instead of having to focus on oral sex in her writing, she could focus on, in this author's inflection, or in the article author's inflection, she could focus on more important things. And to me, what I love the most about these scenes of physical intimacy in so many of these books is that they're used to further unpack some of the real questions that can come up about power and identity and like equality in the relationship, because I think it's an important dynamic. And so much can be, the sex scene is an, I think, can be a really important vehicle for an author to explore some of the more nuanced dynamics of a relationship, and to say that it's less important or less good because it also is next to a scene about, you know, describing something sexual, to me, it diminishes and disallows someone to explore an art form.
We have been very spoiled that in the short amount of time we've been doing this, there have been a couple relationships that we've really started to navigate, negotiate, and grow with some authors one-on-one. One of the authors I talk to on a fairly regular basis spoke to me about anytime she gets a negative review, it's super nitpicky, like to the point of like not liking that a character chose to turn this way down the street instead of that, or what they're wearing, or X, Y, Z. These mm-hmm. little tiny minuscule things that are a writer's choice. It's not even in like really important to plot narrative mm-hmm. and how incredibly nitpicky these reviews get about attacking the author's writing style. The same author also went on to express to me that it comes into like the romantic affection that these characters show to each other and the breaking apart, which is what you just said. Mm-hmm. I would be very interested to know just statistically, percentage wise, how many other authors of other genres are in such a microscopic negative component of reviews. You and I made a very real choice at the beginning of creating this podcast that instead of saying things that we maybe didn't like, if there was anything, instead to focus on questions we had or times we got kicked out and we were reminded that we were reading something. We weren't fully in the narrative. Mm-hmm. We were, oh, this is a book in my hand. I'm cognizant that I'm holding a book. You have mentioned already in today's recording, and I have talked about it, but if you really want to see like just toxicity within a community, go and read the 1 and 2 star reviews within Lesfic. It is so personally driven and aimed at people and at the authors. We are some of our own worst freaking critics, and the ability to have discourse about something that you don't necessarily enjoy versus canceling it because it isn't exactly what you wanted it to be resounds and resonates so much within this community.
Mm-hmm.
There's our super serious moment of the episode.
Yeah. We always have to have at least one.
Okay. One of the people like closest to us in our life was mm-hmm. talking to us about how the thing that kicks her out most is how often one, if not both of these women, are really financially stable, and how it seems that so many of these romances are based on the idea that one of the partners has very easy access to money, very easy access to adventure, incredibly easy access to taking time off of work, mm-hmm. and these romances flourish in worlds where there is a certain amount of financial power. And she said that she doesn't find herself reading very many or even doing research to find others because the entire idea of seeing women so incredibly compensated for their work ethic is enough to just make her bitter about how most of us are not.
I mean, I get it. I think that sentiment lives next to the sentiment that we also heard, which was, there's nothing at stake here because in these novels, the characters are so privileged and powerful and have access to like wealth and power that nothing, you know, the actions of the book can't take that away from them. So the real life fallout from anything can never be truly felt. That's a hard one for me to respond to because I understand the sentiment. I think I'm willing often as a reader to lean into the fantastical element of some of of this, I think of authors like Melissa Braden, I think does a good job where the structures of power in her novels are sometimes so stark and the positions that people hold can be so wild.
Can you give me a viable example?
Like Broadway actress turned celebrity getting all of the movie deals. That's something that...
You're talking about Waiting in the
Wings. I'm talking about Waiting in the Wings. I'm even talking about like Seven Shores, the first book of Seven Shores, where it's about a television writer in a company that has like all the money in the world. And, you know, she magically gets back on her feet with an even better television deal. And she falls into a relationship with her employee slash mentee slash a newbie into the relationship. And they both come out of it stars. What I was going to say before I went off on a tangent of just describing awesome characters from Melissa Braden's books, because I do have such a soft, I'm a fangirl. What I was going to say is I feel like she's a great example of someone who puts her characters into these positions of power. And I don't know if I would go so far as to say that she takes the pin out of that power, because her characters all remain really comfortable and really entrenched into these sort of upper echelons that they come from. But she backs it up with such a wealth of knowledge and with such a nuanced sketch of the character that I'm fine with falling into the narrative. What I don't love is when a character's entire being is wrapped up in their wealth, and the only things that we learn about them and their personality are like they're super finicky because they're super wealthy and they don't know how to make coffee, and that's like a cute point that comes up later in a proposal because they're so rich that they've never had to make a cup of coffee. I'm just made that up. That's probably
okay. I was like, I haven't heard that one.
No, but like
doesn't everybody just buy their coffee most places?
True. Let's talk about economic privilege. So I think I'm fine with suspending my disbelief for these power structures as long as the characters feel real and they sort of are forced to unpack their own privilege and their own power. The only book that I had a real issue with, like the idea of power, I'm a glorified assistant half the time at my job. The other half the time I'm absolutely running shit. I read a novel that was about a CEO and her assistant romance, and that hit too close to home for me. That like immediately I was like, no way. This is like upending, you know, I knew too much about what that dynamic is really like to be okay to suspend my disbelief to enter into the narrative. So I don't know what that says about me. Like, I don't know if that makes me a bad reader or something, but
I think we all have stuff that kicks us out. I think authors have to take risks and they have to write characters outside of themselves. I think when you do that, you also take the risk of potentially writing something that somebody has more knowledge about and that may kick that person out. You're also not writing for one reader. So
write,
be the badass you are.
I think that's why I get so protective and so worked up about these tropes and about the negative things that you see under a New York Times article about romance novels, because it, you know, I feel so protective because it feels like such a gift that I have found for myself as a reader.
Caitlin, at the end, we talk about what we've read this last week. Full disclosure, I took a brief hiatus and a little bit of a break. I had a stack of other stuff I wanted to read. And, you know, we don't talk about other genres, but there are amazing books everywhere. So I did listen to EJ Noyes's Gold recently. It was the book I listened to at work. Like every EJ Noyes novel, I just recommend it 100%. I'm a huge Noyes fan. And then in my queue for this week, is Reinventing Lindsay by Maggie Brown and Blurred Lines by Katie Williamson. And I'm super excited for Katie Williamson series because I get multiple narratives and God knows I love a good series.
Yeah. So. I have also been taking a break. I've been rewatching season 5 and 6 of The Real Housewives of New York. I like to think that I can convince any person to watch a Bravo reality TV show, and I have a specific playlist to introduce people to The Real Housewives. Rebecca is shaking her head no, but I haven't tested it yet on her. So that's
I have been in your life for 6-7 years. I have been present for Real Housewife marathons. I am super.
And when we lived together, you knew the names of the Real Housewives of Orange County. So don't even play.
I did, but yeah. We've also established I do my homework.
Yeah. So that's what I've been. I've been overworked like mad this week. So I finished Chef Special, which I mentioned last episode was in my queue by Susan X. Meager. Like, so good. I'm probably going to do a deep dive into her writing. And in my queue, I have the first book of the Honor series by Radcliffe. I've also been exploring. I'm trying to get out of my comfort zone with authors that I'm reading. So I'm going to read Creatures of Will and Temper by Molly Tanzer. I don't even know if this counts as a romance novel, but it's queer. It's vaguely Victorian era, has some notes of Dorian Gray. So we'll see. So, Rebecca, where can people find you if they want to talk more?
You can find me on Instagram at Rebecca Writes a Romance. Or you can find me on Twitter at Rebecca ATTT Pod. I respond pretty well and pretty quickly on both. Messaging, I'm a little bit more consistent on Twitter these days. Yeah, I promise to overcompliment you and be awkward all in the same sentence. It's a gift. It's a wonderful, unique gift. Caitlin, where can people find you?
I am most often found and most responsive on Instagram. You can find me at Same Sex in the City. I'm also on Twitter, lurking often at Same Sex the City. And then if you want to learn more about the podcast or talk to us about any aspect of an episode, you can find us on Twitter at ATTTPod. Or you can find us on Instagram at A Tip of the Tongue. Yeah, the final words I want to leave with everyone are read more lesbian romance novels.
Or listen.
Watch or listen. Have a queer as fuck weekend.
Queer as fuck weekend.